Chapter 2 The Riddles of the Gospel. To understand the nature of this chapter, it is necessary to recur to the nature of this book. The argument which is meant to be the backbone of the book is of the kind called the reductio ad absurdum. It suggests that the results of assuming the rationalist thesis are more irrational than ours. But to prove it, we must assume that thesis. Thus, in the first section, I often treated man as merely an animal to show that the effect was more impossible than if he were treated as an angel. In the sense in which it was necessary to treat man merely as an animal, it is necessary to treat Christ merely as a man. I have to suspend my own beliefs, which are much more positive, and assume this limitation even in order to remove it. I must try to imagine what would happen to a man who did really read the story of Christ as the story of a man, and even of a man of whom he had never heard before. And I wish to point out that a really impartial reading of that kind would lead, if not immediately to belief, at least to a bewilderment of which there is really no solution except in belief. In this chapter, for this reason, I shall bring in nothing of the spirit of my own creed. I shall exclude the very style of diction and even of lettering which I should think fitting in speaking in my own person. I am speaking as an imaginary heathen human being, honestly staring at the gospel story for the first time. Now, it is not at all easy to regard the New Testament as a New Testament. It is not at all easy to realize the good news as new. Both for good and evil, familiarity fills us with assumptions and associations. And no man of our civilization, whatever he thinks of our religion, can really read the thing as if he had never heard of it before. Of course, it is in any case utterly unhistorical to talk as if the New Testament were a neatly bound book that had fallen from heaven. It is simply the selection made by the authority of the Church from a mass of early Christian literature. But apart from any such question, there is a psychological difficulty in feeling the New Testament as new. There is a psychological difficulty in seeing those well-known words simply as they stand and without going beyond what they intrinsically stand for. And this difficulty must indeed be very great, for the result of it is very curious. The result of it is that most modern critics and most current criticism, even popular criticism, makes a comment that is the exact reverse of the truth. It is so completely the reverse of the truth that one could almost suspect that they had never read the New Testament at all. We have all heard people say 100 times over, for they seem never to tire of saying it, that the Jesus of the New Testament is indeed a most merciful and humane lover of humanity, but that the Church has hidden this human character in repellent dogmas and stiffened it with ecclesiastical terrors till it has taken on an inhuman character. This is, I venture to repeat, very nearly the reverse of the truth. The truth is that it is the image of Christ in the churches that is almost entirely mild and merciful. It is the image of Christ in the Gospels that is a good many other things as well. The figure in the Gospels does indeed utter in words of almost heartbreaking beauty his pity for our broken hearts. But they are very far from being the only sort of words that he utters. Nevertheless, they are almost the only kind of words that the Church in its popular imagery ever represents him as uttering. That popular imagery is inspired by a perfectly sound popular instinct. The mass of the poor are broken, and the mass of the people are poor, and for the mass of mankind, the main thing is to carry the conviction of the incredible compassion of God. But nobody with his eyes open can doubt that it is chiefly this idea of compassion that the popular machinery of the Church does seek to carry. The popular imagery carries a great deal to excess the sentiment of gentle Jesus, meek and mild. It is the first thing that the outsider feels and criticizes in a pietà or a shrine of the Sacred Heart. As I say, While the art may be insufficient, I am not sure that the instinct is unsound. In any case, there is something appalling, something that makes the blood run cold in the idea of having a statue of Christ in wrath. There is something insupportable, even to the imagination, in the idea of turning the corner of a street or coming out into the spaces of a marketplace to meet the petrifying petrifaction of that figure as it turned upon a generation of vipers, or that face as it looked at the face of a hypocrite. The church can reasonably be justified, therefore, if she turns the most merciful face or aspect towards men. But it is certainly the most merciful aspect that she does turn. And the point is here that it is very much more specially and exclusively merciful than any impression that could be formed by a man merely reading the New Testament for the first time. A man simply taking the words of the story as they stand would form quite another impression, an impression full of mystery and possibly of inconsistency, but certainly not merely an impression of mildness. It would be intensely interesting, but part of the interest would consist in its leaving a good deal to be guessed at or explained. It is full of sudden gestures, evidently significant, except that we hardly know what they signify, of enigmatic silences, of ironical replies. The outbreaks of wrath, like storms above our atmosphere, do not seem to break out exactly where we should expect them, but to follow some higher weather chart of their own. The Peter whom popular church teaching presents is very rightly the Peter to whom Christ said in forgiveness, "Feed my lambs." He is not the Peter upon whom Christ turned as if he were the devil, crying in that obscure wrath, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Christ lamented with nothing but love and pity over Jerusalem, which was to murder him. We do not know what strange spiritual atmosphere or spiritual insight led him to sink Bethsaida lower in the pit than Sodom. I am putting aside for the moment all questions of doctrinal inferences or expositions, orthodox or otherwise. I am simply imagining the effect on a man's mind if he did really do what these critics are always talking about doing. If he did really read the New Testament without reference to orthodoxy and even without reference to doctrine, he would find a number of things which fit in far less with the current unorthodoxy than they do with the current orthodoxy. He would find, for instance, that if there are any descriptions that deserve to be called realistic, they are precisely the descriptions of the supernatural. If there is one aspect of the New Testament Jesus in which he may be said to present himself eminently as a practical person, it is in the aspect of an exorcist. There is nothing meek and mild, there is nothing, even in the ordinary sense, mystical, about the tone of the voice that says, "Hold thy peace and come out of him." It is much more like the tone of a very business-like lion tamer or a strong-minded doctor dealing with a homicidal maniac. But this is only a side issue for the sake of illustration. I am not now raising these controversies, but considering the case of the imaginary man from the moon to whom the New Testament is new. Now, the first thing to note is that if we take it merely as a human story, it is in some ways a very strange story. I do not refer here to its tremendous and tragic culmination or to any implications involving triumph in that tragedy. I do not refer to what is commonly called the miraculous element, for on that point philosophies vary and modern philosophies very decidedly waver. Indeed, the educated Englishman of today may be said to have passed from an old fashion in which he would not believe in any miracles unless they were ancient, and adopted a new fashion, in which he will not believe in any miracles unless they are modern. He used to hold that miraculous cures stopped with the first Christian, and is now inclined to suspect that they began with the first Christian scientists. But I refer here rather specially to unmiraculous and even to unnoticed and inconspicuous parts of the story. There are a great many things about it which nobody would have invented, for they are things that nobody has ever made any particular use of. Things which, if they were remarked at all, have remained rather as puzzles. For instance, there is that long stretch of silence in the life of Christ up to the age of 30. It is, of all silences, the most immense and imaginatively impressive. But it is not the sort of thing that anybody is particularly likely to invent in order to prove something, and nobody, so far as I know, has ever tried to prove anything in particular from it. It is impressive, but it is only impressive as a fact. There is nothing particularly popular or obvious about it as a fable. The ordinary trend of hero worship and myth-making is much more likely to say the precise opposite. It is much more likely to say, as I believe some of the Gospels rejected by the Church do say, that Jesus displayed a divine precocity and began his mission at a miraculously early age. And there is indeed something strange in the thought that he who of all humanity needed least preparation seems to have had most. Whether it was some mode of the divine humility or some truth of which we see the shadow in the longer domestic tutelage of the higher creatures of the earth, I do not propose to speculate. I mention it simply as an example of the sort of thing that does in any case give rise to speculations, quite apart from recognized religious speculations. Now, the whole story is full of these things. It is not by any means as baldly presented in print a story that is easy to get to the bottom of. It is anything but what these people talk of as a simple gospel. Relatively speaking, it is the gospel that has the mysticism and the church that has the rationalism. As I should put it, of course, it is the gospel that is the riddle and the church that is the answer. But whatever be the answer, the gospel as it stands is almost a book of riddles. First, a man reading the gospel sayings would not find platitudes if he had read, even in the most respectful spirit, the majority of ancient philosophers and of modern moralists. He would appreciate the unique importance of saying that he did not find platitudes. It is more than can be said even of Plato. It is much more that can be said of Epictetus or Seneca or Marcus Aurelius or Apollonius of Tyana. And it is immeasurably more than can be said of most of the agnostic moralists and the preachers of the ethical societies, with their songs of service and their religion of brotherhood. The morality of most moralists, ancient and modern, has been one solid and polished cataract of platitudes flowing forever and ever. That would certainly not be the impression of the imaginary independent outsider studying the New Testament. He would be conscious of nothing so commonplace and, in a sense, of nothing so continuous as that stream. He would find a number of strange claims that might sound like the claim to be the brother of the sun and moon, a number of very startling pieces of advice, a number of stunning rebukes, a number of strangely beautiful stories. He would see some very gigantesque figures of speech about the impossibility of threading a needle with a camel, or the possibility of throwing a mountain into the sea. He would see a number of very daring simplifications of the difficulties of life, like the advice to shine upon everybody indifferently as does the sunshine, or not to worry about the future any more than the birds. He would find, on the other hand, some passages of almost impenetrable darkness, so far as he is concerned, such as the moral of the parable of the unjust steward. Some of these things might strike him as fables and some as truths, but none as truisms. For instance, he would not find the ordinary platitudes in favor of peace. He would find several paradoxes in favor of peace. He would find several ideals of non-resistance, which, taken as they stand, would be rather too pacific for any pacifist. He would be told in one passage to treat a robber not with passive resistance, but rather with positive and enthusiastic encouragement, if the terms be taken literally, heaping up gifts upon the man who had stolen goods. but he would not find a word of all that obvious rhetoric against war which has filled countless books and odes and orations. Not a word about the wickedness of war, the wastefulness of war, the appalling scale of the slaughter in war, and all the rest of the familiar frenzy. Indeed, not a word about war at all. There is nothing that throws any particular light on Christ's attitude towards organized warfare, except that he seems to have been rather fond of Roman soldiers. Indeed, it is another perplexity, speaking from the same external and human standpoint, that he seems to have got on much better with Romans than he did with Jews. But the question here is a certain tone to be appreciated by merely reading a certain text, and we might give any number of instances of it. The statement that the meek shall inherit the earth is very far from being a meek statement. I mean, it is not meek in the ordinary sense of mild and moderate and inoffensive. To justify it, it would be necessary to go very deep into history and anticipate things undreamed of then and by many unrealized even now, such as the way in which the mystical monks reclaimed the lands which the practical kings had lost. If it was a truth at all, it was because it was a prophecy, but certainly it was not a truth in the sense of a truism. The blessing upon the meek would seem to be a very violent statement in the sense of doing violence to reason and probability. And with this, we come to another important stage in the speculation. As a prophecy, it really was fulfilled, but it was only fulfilled long afterwards. The monasteries were the most practical and prosperous estates and experiments in reconstruction after the barbaric deluge. The meek did really inherit the earth. But nobody could have known anything of the sort at the time, unless, indeed, there was one who knew. Something of the same may be said about the incident of Martha and Mary, which has been interpreted in retrospect and from the inside by the mystics of the Christian contemplative life. But it was not at all an obvious view of it, and most moralists, ancient and modern, could be trusted to make a rush for the obvious. What torrents of effortless eloquence would have flowed from them to swell any slight superiority on the part of Martha? What splendid sermons about the joy of service and the gospel of work, and the world's left better than we found it, and generally all the 10,000 platitudes that can be uttered in favor of taking trouble by people who need take no trouble to utter them. If in Mary, the mystic and child of love, Christ was guarding the seed of something more subtle, who was likely to understand it at the time? Nobody else could have seen Claire and Catherine and Teresa shining above the little roof at Bethany. It is so in another way with that magnificent menace about bringing into the world a sword to sunder and divide. Nobody could have guessed then either how it could be fulfilled or how it could be justified. Indeed, some freethinkers are still so simple as to fall into the trap and be shocked at a phrase so deliberately defiant. They actually complain of the paradox for not being a platitude. But the point here is that if we could read the gospel reports as things as new as newspaper reports, they would puzzle us and perhaps terrify us much more than the same things as developed by historical Christianity. For instance, Christ, after a clear allusion to the eunuchs of Eastern courts, said there would be eunuchs of the kingdom of heaven. If this does not mean the voluntary enthusiasm of virginity, it could only be made to mean something much more unnatural or uncouth. It is the historical religion that humanizes it for us by the experience of Franciscans or of Sisters of Mercy. The mere statement standing by itself might very well suggest a rather dehumanized atmosphere, the sinister and inhuman silence of the Asiatic harem and divan. This is but one instance out of scores, but the moral is that the Christ of the gospel might actually seem more strange and terrible than the Christ of the church. I am dwelling on the dark or dazzling or defiant or mysterious side of the gospel words, not because they had not obviously a more obvious and popular side, but because this is the answer to a common criticism on a vital point. The freethinker frequently says that Jesus of Nazareth was a man of his time, even if he was in advance of his time, and that we cannot accept his ethics as final for humanity. The freethinker then goes on to criticize his ethics, saying, plausibly enough, that men cannot turn the other cheek, or that they must take thought for the moral, or that the self-denial is too ascetic, or the monogamy too severe. But the zealots and the legionaries did not turn the other cheek any more than we do, if so much. The Jewish traders and Roman tax gatherers took thought for the morrow as much as we, if not more. We cannot pretend to be abandoning the morality of the past for one more suited to the present. It is certainly not the morality of another age, but it might be of another world. In short, we can say that these ideals are impossible in themselves. Exactly what we cannot say is that they are impossible for us. They are rather notably marked by a mysticism, which, if it be a part of madness, would always have struck the same sort of people as mad. Take, for instance, the case of marriage and the relations of the sexes. It might very well have been true that a Galilean teacher taught things natural to a Galilean environment, but it is not. It might rationally be expected that a man in the time of Tiberius would have advanced a view conditioned by the time of Tiberius, but he did not. What he advanced was something quite different, something very difficult, but something no more difficult now than it was then. When, for instance, Muhammad made his polygamous compromise, we may reasonably say that it was conditioned by a polygamous society. When he allowed a man four wives, he was really doing something suited to the circumstances, which might have been less suited to other circumstances. Nobody will pretend that the four wives were like the four winds, something seemingly a part of the order of nature. Nobody will say that the figure four was written forever in stars upon the sky. But neither will anyone say that the figure four is an inconceivable ideal, that it is beyond the power of the mind of man to count up to four, or to count the number of his wives and see whether it amounts to four. It is a practical compromise carrying with it the character of a particular society. If Muhammad had been born in Acton in the 19th century, we may well doubt whether he would instantly have filled that suburb with harems of four wives apiece. As he was born in Arabia in the 6th century, he did in his conjugal arrangements suggest the conditions of Arabia in the 6th century. But Christ, in his view of marriage, does not in the least suggest the conditions of Palestine in the 1st century. He does not suggest anything at all except the sacramental view of marriage as developed long afterwards by the Catholic Church. It was quite as difficult for people then as for people now. It was much more puzzling to people then than to people now. Jews and Romans and Greeks did not believe and did not even understand enough to disbelieve the mystical idea that the man and the woman had become one sacramental substance. We may think it an incredible or impossible ideal, but we cannot think it any more incredible or impossible than they would have thought it. In other words, whatever else is true, it is not true that the controversy has been altered by time. Whatever else is true, it is emphatically not true that the ideas of Jesus of Nazareth were suitable to his time but are no longer suitable to our time. Exactly how suitable they were to his time is perhaps suggested in the end of his story. The same truth might be stated in another way, by saying that if the story be regarded as merely human and historical, it is extraordinary how very little there is in the recorded words of Christ that ties him at all to his own time. I do not mean the details of a period, which even a man of the period knows to be passing. I mean the fundamentals, which even the wisest man often vaguely assumes to be eternal. For instance, Aristotle was perhaps the wisest and most wide-minded man who ever lived. He founded himself entirely upon fundamentals, which have been generally found to remain rational and solid through all social and historical changes. Still, he lived in a world in which it was thought as natural to have slaves as to have children. And therefore, he did permit himself a serious recognition of a difference between slaves and free men. Christ, as much as Aristotle, lived in a world that took slavery for granted. He did not particularly denounce slavery. He started a movement that could exist in a world with slavery. But he started a movement that could exist in a world without slavery. He never used a phrase that made his philosophy depend even upon the very existence of the social order in which he lived. He spoke as one conscious that everything was ephemeral, including the things that Aristotle thought eternal. By that time, the Roman Empire had come to be merely the Orbis Terrarum, another name for the world. But he never made his morality dependent on the existence of the Roman Empire, or even on the existence of the world. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. The truth is that when critics have spoken of the local limitations of the Galilean, it has always been a case of the local limitations of the critics. He did undoubtedly believe in certain things that one particular modern sect of materialists do not believe, but they were not things particularly peculiar to his time. It would be nearer the truth to say that the denial of them is quite peculiar to our time. Doubtless it would be nearer still to the truth to say merely that a certain solemn social importance in the minority disbelieving them is peculiar to our time. He believed, for instance, in evil spirits or in the psychic healing of bodily ills, but not because he was a Galilean born under Augustus. It is absurd to say that a man believed things because he was a Galilean under Augustus, when he might have believed the same things if he had been an Egyptian under Tutankhamun or an Indian under Genghis Khan. But with this general question of the philosophy of diabolism or of divine miracles, I deal elsewhere. It is enough to say that the materialists have to prove the impossibility of miracles against the testimony of all mankind, not against the prejudices of provincials in North Palestine under the first Roman emperors. What they have to prove for the present argument is the presence in the Gospels of those particular prejudices of those particular provincials. And humanly speaking, it is astonishing how little they can produce even to make a beginning of proving it. So it is in this case of the sacrament of marriage. We may not believe in sacraments as we may not believe in spirits, but it is quite clear that Christ believed in this sacrament in his own way and not in any current or contemporary way. He certainly did not get his argument against divorce from the Mosaic law or the Roman law or the habits of the Palestinian people. It would appear to his critics then exactly what it appears to his critics now, an arbitrary and transcendental dogma coming from nowhere save in the sense that it came from him. I am not at all concerned here to defend that dogma. The point here is that it is just as easy to defend it now as it was to defend it then. It is an ideal altogether outside time, difficult at any period, impossible at no period. In other words, if anyone says it is what might be expected of a man walking about in that place at that period, we can quite fairly answer that it is much more like what might be the mysterious utterance of a being beyond man, if he walked alive among men. I maintain, therefore, that a man reading the New Testament frankly and freshly would not get the impression of what is now often meant by a human Christ. The merely human Christ is a made-up figure, a piece of artificial selection like the merely evolutionary man. Moreover, there have been too many of these human Christs found in the same story, just as there have been too many keys to mythology found in the same stories. Three or four separate schools of rationalism have worked over the ground and produced three or four equally rational explanations of his life. the first rational explanation of his life was that he never lived. And this in turn gave an opportunity for three or four different explanations, as that he was a sun myth or a corn myth, or any other kind of myth that is also a monomania. Then the idea that he was a divine being who did not exist gave place to the idea that he was a human being who did exist. In my youth, it was the fashion to say that he was merely an ethical teacher in the manner of the Essenes, who had apparently nothing very much to say that Hillel or 100 other Jews might not have said, as that is a kindly thing to be kind and an assistance to purification to be pure. Then somebody said he was a madman with a messianic delusion. Then others said he was indeed an original teacher because he cared nothing about socialism or, as others said, about nothing but pacifism. Then a more grimly scientific character appeared, who said that Jesus would never have been heard of at all except for his prophecies of the end of the world. He was important merely as a millenarian, like Dr. Cumming, and created a provincial scare by announcing the exact date of the crack of doom. Among other variants on the same theme was the theory that he was a spiritual healer and nothing else, a view implied by Christian Science, which has really to expound the Christianity without the crucifixion in order to explain the curing of Peter's wife's mother or the daughter of a centurion. There is another theory that concentrates entirely on the business of diabolism and what it would call the contemporary superstition about demoniacs, as if Christ, like a young deacon taking his first orders, and got as far as exorcism and never got any further. Now, each of these explanations in itself seems to me singularly inadequate, but taken together, they do suggest something of the very mystery which they miss. There must surely have been something not only mysterious, but many-sided about Christ, if so many smaller Christs can be carved out of him. If the Christian Scientist is satisfied with him as a spiritual healer, and the Christian Socialist is satisfied with him as a social reformer, so satisfied that they do not even expect him to be anything else, it looks as if he really covered rather more ground than they could be expected to expect. And it does seem to suggest that there might be more than they fancy in these other mysterious attributes of casting out devils or prophesying doom. Above all, would not such a new reader of the New Testament stumble over something that would startle him much more than it startles us? I have here more than once attempted the rather impossible task of reversing time and the historic method, and in fancy looking forward to the facts instead of backward through the memories. So I have imagined the monster that man might have seemed at first to the mere nature around him. We should have a worse shock if we really imagined the nature of Christ named for the first time. What should we feel at the first whisper of a certain suggestion about a certain man? Certainly it is not for us to blame anybody who should find that first wild whisper merely impious and insane. On the contrary, stumbling on that rock of scandal is the first step. Stark staring incredulity is a far more loyal tribute to that truth than a modernist metaphysic that would make it out merely a matter of degree. It were better to rend our robes with a great cry against blasphemy like Caiaphas in the judgment, or to lay hold of the man as a maniac possessed of devils like the kinsman and the crowd, rather than to stand stupidly debating fine shades of pantheism in the presence of so catastrophic a claim. There is more of the wisdom that is one with surprise in any simple person full of the sensitiveness of simplicity who should expect the grass to wither and the birds to drop dead out of the air, when a strolling carpenter's apprentice said calmly and almost carelessly, like one looking over his shoulder, "Before Abraham was, I am."